This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Professor Walter Johnson at Harvard University. He is the leading American historian specializing in the history of slavery, capitalism, and imperialism. And New Orleans, as he puts it, was slave market central, in particular the French Quarter, where 120,000 slaves were sold in 40 years between 1820 and 1860. Should the French Quarter be off limits based on its sordid history? We'll talk about it with Walter Johnson. Also, John LaPuma, the best-selling author, on some ideas on how men can stay fit as they age. He says men have no excuse not to shed fat, boost testosterone, and pump up strength and stamina. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing. Your numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you are. If you're dialing locally, 297-5633. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Our guest is Professor Walter Johnson of Harvard University. He's been there for 6 years, the leading American historian specializing in the history of slavery, capitalism, and imperialism, best-selling author of several works, including Inside the Antebellum Slave Market and Slavery or River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom. This is a topic that has resurfaced in our state and in our nation. As we know, a few weeks ago, Ani DeFranco canceled a celebration of her life and of literature at Nottoway based on an outcry of opposition because of where the event was going to take place. Last week, the winner of the Ernest Gaines Award, Attica Locke, said that anybody who gets married at a plantation should think twice because of the history of slavery in plantations in Louisiana and elsewhere. But Walter Johnson has spent much of his time in New Orleans, where it was slave market central, and he has some ideas about why slavery prevailed in New Orleans at that time and whether or not that sordid history is reflective of contemporary life and should be considered as far as New Orleans today. Good morning, Dr. Johnson.
Good morning. How you doing?
Doing well. Well, you have been to New Orleans many times. I know you've led some tours of the what was then Slave Market Central around, 1854?
Yeah, really, for the entire 18th century and into the 19th century, there were several slave markets in New Orleans, and they moved around geographically. But the sort of high water mark of the interstate slave trade in the 19th century, there were two main market areas: one in the central business district, and one right near the corner on near Frenchman Street.
The numbers are staggering. Well over 100,000 human beings, slaves, sold in the French Quarter, right?
Yep, that's right. That's right. No, it is, and that's just between 1820 and 1860, and that is, I should add, really only professionally brokered sales. And so, if you can add in sales that occur between neighbor and neighbor, and the numbers would only go up. That's part of a tremendous transformation in slavery in the United States, which involves a movement of the institution from the Upper South, from Virginia, North Carolina, down to Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And that transformation in American slavery that is, that underwrites the cotton boom involves the forced relocation of around 1 million enslaved people. So that's one of the largest forced migrations in human history.
297-5633 for Dr. Walter Johnson of Harvard University and America's and the world's most prominent expert on slavery in the United States. And New Orleans is the worst place where this occurred, a sordid history. Should that affect people when they visit New Orleans or where they want to do business there? Is this something that is so poisonous to the culture then that it has an impact today?
Well, I actually liked what you said right at the beginning when you quoted the man who said that people should think twice. And think twice, you know, you can have a couple of meanings for think twice. And I like the idea of think twice as just sort of a double vision, which is to try to think about New Orleans and take it in for the wonderful, extraordinary, beautiful city that it is, and to recognize that the roots of that beauty, to recognize who did the work, and to recognize the conditions of that labor. Who cut down all the trees that made the forest into fields, and who levied the river, and who toted the bricks and churned the mortar and put it all together. And that seems to me to be the way that I would like people to think about it, is not to imagine that, you know, that we need to pretend that New Orleans is not a beautiful city or not a culturally rich and diverse city, but that we need to also embrace alongside that vision a vision of the human suffering that made all that possible.
297-5633 for Dr. Walter Johnson, and we'll go to the phone lines in just a moment. But as far as particular streets, you have given tours of New Orleans. There are certain places where slave trade was quite prominent.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you were to, I mean, in Barone, the corner of Gravier and Barone Street in the 1850s was a there were several slave markets organized, sort of several little slave pens right there. And so what a slave pen would be, a lot with a high fence and a house and maybe a prison on it. And there would be, you know, 150 people for sale at a time on this home lot. And right around that corner, there were four or five different lots of that type. And then in that area, there were probably 12 or 15 different similar lots. And that's very, very similar on the downtown side of the French Quarter, right around Esplanade and where Esplanade meets Charter Street, right on that corner and around there. From the 1820s on, there were several different privately held slave markets.
People in pens, you say?
Yeah, well, the pen was the term that was used to describe the slave market, and so it is an objectifying and it is an animalizing term. That's not my term. That's a historical term. But what that means really is a prison where people slept, often in doors that locked only from the, in rooms that had doors that locked only from the outside. You know, multiple people in a room, and then in the daytime there was a yard. You know, just like there is in any kind of home lot in the French Quarter today, and people would, you know, spend part of the day outside and then part of the day inside, being sold, being investigated by buyers, being questioned, interrogated by buyers, being stripped down and investigated, physically manipulated by buyers. That was really what happened every day. For decades in those areas of the city.
What did it cost to buy a slave?
Well, the price of enslaved people varies with the price of cotton directly. And so when the price of cotton goes higher, then the price of enslaved people goes higher. And in the period of slavery, there was a sort of a common sense calculation that the price of a enslaved man should be 10,000 times the price per pound of cotton. And the price per pound of cotton over that period varies from anywhere from about 7 cents up to even 16, 18 cents. And so that would be yield you a price for a young man of $700 to $1,600, $1,800 at the peak of the market.
So between $700 and $1,800 for a human being in 1850 or 60, somewhere around.
Right.
Which
is, at that time, it's a significant amount of money. That's, if you did the math and converted it out to present day dollars, that would be $20,000 or $30,000.
So 297-5633 is your number, and we will go to the phone lines with Dr. Walter Johnson of Harvard University. And I'm sure there are people who are listening at this time who did not know this and may think, you know, I don't want any part of New Orleans. That how can people have fun and frivolity and celebrate Mardi Gras and Super Bowls and Sugar Bowls amid a place that was so sinister in its treatment of other humans?
Well, that's certainly something that I have thought about as I've walked the streets in New Orleans, and sometimes I feel haunted by that legacy, by that memory. And I certainly think that there are appropriate and inappropriate ways to memorialize the past. And I think we could probably think of concrete examples of, I can think of one right on the corner of, what is it, Royal Street, where is the Slave Exchange restaurant. For me, that grates. Right. For me, that seems a Pierre Maspero's Slave Exchange. That seems to me, I think that's on the corner of St. Louis Street and Royal Street, maybe. Bothers me.
Yeah. Well,
I think that the other thing that we need to, as I said, I think we need to recognize the legacy of enslaved people as workers in building that city. Right, in building not just the city of New Orleans. I mean, I think it would be wrong to make this a conversation that's simply about what was the role of slavery in the history of the city of New Orleans. Well, what about the role of slavery in the history of the United States? Right, the wealth that was produced in the Mississippi Valley that was sold through New Orleans is the wealth that underwrote the entire history of United States economic development in the 19th century. And so I think it would be wrong to imagine that the debt that the United States owes enslaved people is located in New Orleans. I think we could just as well go to New York City, or I could go around to Harvard University, and there are buildings on this campus that were paid for by the labor of enslaved people. So
at Harvard.
Yeah, absolutely. And all these, at Brown, at Princeton, So for me, I try always to embrace that kind of double vision that you began with, to try to think about the legacy, the debt that I owe, that we owe, that mm-hmm. our cities owe and our universities owe and our nation owes to the labor of enslaved people, but also to to appreciate the wonderful things that the city of New Orleans represents.
Veronica in Denham Springs. Veronica, good morning. You're on with Dr. Walter Johnson.
Hi. I grew up in the shadows of Nottoway, and as a young black girl in the South, I struggled. It's a beautiful, beautiful house, beautiful home, but I went from being angry to sad to ultimately being proud. I actually had ancestors that worked at plantation, but those were people that overcame unspeakable obstacles so I could grow up and have opportunities. And everything that I go through pales in comparison to what they had to struggle. So now when I see that plantation, I feel proud, not so much shame anymore, that I'm able to be Dr. Veronica, because those people didn't give up and didn't quit, and they had hope, and I couldn't imagine having that.
All right, Dr. Johnson, would you respond to Veronica? Did you hear her remarks, Dr.?
Yes, I did. I'm sorry, I lost you for a second there. I think that's fantastic. I mean, I think that the caller's emphasis on we built this. Right on this as an achievement belongs right alongside her sadness and her outrage, and that seems to me that we need to try and imagine a mindset in which we can hold all of those things together, in which we can appreciate the labor, the talents of enslaved people, even as we absolutely, unconditionally condemn and continue to memorialize the circumstances under which it was extracted.
297-5633. We'll return with Dr. Walter Johnson of Harvard University, one of his books, Soul by Soul, Life Inside the Antebellum Slave Market. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're back with Dr. Walter Johnson of the great university at Harvard. He is the foremost expert on slaves in America and slave trading in the 19th century, primarily in New Orleans alone, in the French Quarter. 120,000 slaves sold between 1820 and 1860. Last week on this show, Attica Locke, I think she brought up a good discussion. Should we refrain from having celebrations at plantations and other places where slave trading was prominent? Is it such that it poisons the culture to this day? We'd like your thoughts. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. Donald in Mid-City. Donald, good morning. You're on with Dr. Johnson.
Good morning, Dr. Johnson. How are you doing?
Thank you for bringing
awareness to that. I actually lived in New Orleans. My first apartment in New Orleans was on Magazine Street, and I had to go through a door and up a narrow stair and down around into a balcony into a very it was small. It was my first place. I was in college, but what I found out is those were called slave quarters, and I later found out that there's a lot of real estate in New Orleans in the Uptown Garden District that are considered, and in the French Quarter, that are considered slave quarters.
Right.
And they were actually used as slave quarters. And after I began to work, I was hustling to get through law school. I got a job for the Windsor Court as a limo driver, doing specifically plantation tours. And I got to visit every plantation from Destrehan all the way up to Natchez, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found remarkable was, and maybe you can relate on this, there are actually Creole plantations that were owned by blacks or Creoles.
Right.
All right. Would you respond?
Yeah, well, a couple things. I do think that the history of slavery is very, very present in the architectural history of New Orleans, and certainly those detached outbuildings, a lot of them were slave quarters, and that to me is one of the things that I see when I walk through the city that makes me feel that kind of combination of anger and gratitude that we've been talking about. There were free people of color. Some of them who identify themselves or whose ancestors, whose descendants would come to identify themselves as Creoles who own slaves in Louisiana and elsewhere in the South. They are, I think it is important to say, a very, very small proportion of slaveholders. But some of them were right on the margins of the economy, and some of them were quite successful. But it is a small number, but nevertheless a historically interesting set of folks.
297-5633, Bill on I-10. Bill, good morning. You're on the air with Professor Walter Johnson.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. My question to you is, I didn't realize how much slavery and the practice of it was involved in building the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, as well as we were never taught that Christopher Columbus converted the island, the inhabitants of the island that he first landed on to slavery, basically. I think there were Taiwan Indians occupying the Dominican Republic back then, or Haiti.
Right, the island of Hispaniola.
All right, well, what do you think about is slavery going back to beyond the formation of the United States?
Absolutely, unquestionably. I mean, I think that slavery has been integral to many of the great civilizations in human history. And that is something that for the defenders of slavery in the 19th century, they drew
apart from that. They thought, well, you know, look, we're like Greece. We're like Rome. And my view of that is, I think, unsurprisingly, a bit more jaundiced. It brings, it raises for me the question of how do we define civilization? And what is the relationship, the direct relationship of the things that we term civilization to practices of barbarity? And so, again, what I'm interested in again and again is to try to trace out the relationship between human flourishing that we call civilization and the human degradation that is slavery. And we find those two things right next to one another throughout many eras of human history.
Marcia in Clinton. Good morning. You're on with Dr. Johnson.
Hi. How are y'all?
Fine.
Good. Thank you.
I just wanted to make a point. By the way, I do have a degree in history from LSU, and my specialty is American history prior to the Civil War.
Good
so
for
I've
you.
I've taken a lot of courses at LSU, and slavery can never be defended, and looking back on it, and this is a point that I find people seem to forget, that was stressed to me, we don't have the 19th century mindset, and to us it's very easy for us to condemn slavery, or it should be very easy for us. But at the same time, if you look at the United States, as you mentioned before, it's not just the South that profited from this institution, and it wasn't just the Americas. A lot of the wealth in England and Europe was created through this system, particularly the triangular trade.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's wrong to try to ignore the contributions that enslaved people made in spite of their terrible degradation. But at the same time, we need to realize the United States and the world back in the 19th century was a totally different kind of mindset than what we have today. For example, the British thought nothing of uprooting, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of Acadians and shipping them just any old place. And those weren't even enslaved
Absolutely.
People.
I completely agree with that. And I mean, I think that in some way, I think what you're saying is that the foundational mindset of the 18th or the 19th century is, in many cases, white supremacist and patriarchal and pro-slavery. And so that we need to understand that the historical projects of the late 18th and of the 19th century were shaped by that.
Now, Thomas Jefferson, third president, considered by many to be a great president, held slaves and had a relationship with one of them, and Sally Hemings. He acquired the Louisiana Territory, 1803. What did he envision when he did this?
He had a whole bunch of different visions for Louisiana. I think the first vision is one of a republic of independent, white, self-sufficient farmers. And so it is a vision of white flourishing. Now, Jefferson is aware that the Trans-Appalachian West is populated by Native Americans. And so his first vision is Indian removal and the relocation of white men from the eastern seaboard to the west. So it is, you know, as I say, I think it is a vision in which, I mean, it really perfectly exemplifies what the last caller was saying. It's a vision in which liberty for white men is directly twinned with white supremacy. Eventually, Jefferson began to think a little bit differently about the Mississippi Valley. There was an idea that was prominent in his thought that had to do with the diffusion of the African-American population across the continent. In the aftermath of the Haitian Revolution, Jefferson was increasingly worried about the possibility of a slave revolt in the United States. And he actually believed that through the slave trade, the population of enslaved people in Virginia and North Carolina could be spread out so thinly across the entire continent that it would be less dangerous. And indeed, Jefferson believed that the population of enslaved people might actually disappear. And so that turns out to be a wholly erroneous proposition. But that's one of the ways that in the aftermath of the Louisiana Purchase, it actually becomes legal to import enslaved people to.
All right. Paul in Opelousas. Paul, good morning. You're on with Dr. Johnson. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Good morning, Johnson. Good morning, Jim. Just a comment. You know, I was born and raised in the state of Louisiana, and I have yet to visit a plantation officially, because I just had a problem with it. But recently I did an event in North Louisiana, in the King River area, and it is amazing to see the development of plantations up there. It was owned by a lot of Creoles. So what is your comment, or how do you feel that plantations today can better display the true life of what happened? Because our history is a story, and it's a constantly evolving story, as you say, a revolving story.
Well, yeah, I think that's a great question, because I have been on several plantation tours, and without naming any names, I think that they're alienating. And it seems to me that, you know, I feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over, but that alongside the emphasis on fine living and the decorative arts that many plantations focus on, alongside the better homes and gardens version of history, there needs to be a labor history. And I think once those two things are put together, they make each other look different. It seems to me that once you recognize that all of that fine living, all of that better homes and gardens version of history was dependent upon the labor of enslaved people, you think differently about the material culture of the 19th century. And once you recognize that it was enslaved people who were able to build and maintain these beautiful environments, you think differently about the capabilities of enslaved people. So it seems to me that if, you know, if I ran the zoo, if somebody asked me, which on occasion they have, I must say, but, you know, that's the sort of vision that I would hope could be communicated. The other thing is, you know, these plantations, many of them were huge, and they were focused as much on agricultural production as they were on the production of dinner parties. And it seems to me that an important aspect of this story would be to try to portray the role of enslaved labor in staple crop production, and then portray the role of those staple crops in the United States, indeed in the global economy of the 19th century.
Raymond writes, please accept that the vast majority of white Southerners were not slave owners, and that slaves simply did not voluntarily board ships in Africa. They were often sold into slavery by their own people. He says there's plenty of blame to go around.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is true. There is plenty of blame to go around. The fact that there were that societies in Africa were class societies in which exploitation occurred, and that there were unscrupulous Africans as well as unscrupulous Europeans does not seem to me to diminish the salience of the history of slavery to our own history in the United States today.
All right. Nicholas on Nicholson writes, according to this reasoning, Germany should be off limits on account of its slavery and concentration camps, Russia because of its Siberian gulags, Spain because they enslaved and massacred Native American Indians, Paris because of its 1894 guillotine. Following such reasoning, the entire world at one time or another went through some sort of slavery and should be converted into a universal memorial.
Well, it sounds to me like he missed a lot of the conversation, but I think that Germany's a fantastic example. I think that in Germany there is a culture of public memorialization of the outrages of the mid-20th century that I think would be a good example, and a celebration of the, you know, the achievements of Jewish Europeans. So, you know, for me, that's actually a heartening example. And you know, lest I be misunderstood, I think I've been pretty clear in trying to say that I think to imagine that the city of New Orleans or plantations should somehow be off limits because of this history is a mistake. I think that the point is, however, that awareness of this history and indeed even gratitude for the stolen labor and stolen lives of enslaved people should be a part of how people are guided to think about these places.
Was there any place quite like New Orleans as far as slave trading?
New Orleans is the largest antebellum slave market. So, yes, there were places like New Orleans in terms of slave trading, Havana, Rio. But as far as North America, New Orleans is the largest slave market. Charleston has a large slave market. There are a whole complex of slave markets around Washington, D.C., in Alexandria, down to Richmond. And then there are also slave market centers at now more or less forgotten places. Fayetteville, North Carolina was a big slave trading center. Columbus, Georgia was a big slave trading center. And so there's a different there was a significant slave market in Natchez, which has been memorialized for some time at the forks of the road. So there's a geography that's a little bit different than the economic geography of the present day.
You mentioned,
but New Orleans is the paradigm.
You noted the concept of white supremacy. Is that one of the vestiges of slavery? That still goes on, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it is both a vestige of slavery and a symptom of other ills. And so I think the relationship between the history of slavery and the excrescence of present-day white supremacy is a complicated one, you know, probably too complicated for us to riddle out in a couple minutes.
Okay, Kim and Old Goodwood, our final caller for Dr. Walter Johnson. Kim, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Real quickly, I'll try to cut to the chase. I think the last few generations and the next several generations to come after us, I'm 49 years old, privilege to be a person on this planet that is experiencing the changes that are taking place within the races.
All right. Obviously, there has been advancement.
Yeah, I mean, I think one would be silly not to acknowledge the extraordinary. I mean, you know, so for instance, things have happened in my lifetime that as a young person, I thought I would never see. I thought I would never see the end of apartheid in South Africa, right? So I could not, as a child, have imagined the election of Barack Obama as president.
Well, Dr. Johnson, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we do so again soon. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. Walter Johnson, professor at Harvard University.
All right, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. We'll be back with best-selling author John LaPuma. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're visiting with Dr. John LaPuma, board-certified specialist in internal medicine. He's been featured in many places, a national PBS television host, and his book, his latest one, is Men Don't Diet, Men Refuel. He has a plan that he says we can shed fat, boost testosterone, and pump up strength and stamina. Good morning, Dr. LaPuma.
Good morning, Jim. Great to be with you.
Well, nice to talk with you. Now, men, as we get older, our bodies change, as certainly it happens to women as well. But how do men differ from women?
Men store fat right in the middle, Jim, in a hidden gut place that's internal. That fat does a lot of things that aren't in our best interest. Most of all, it turns the testosterone our testes make into estrogen and erodes their drive, ambition, initiative, self-confidence, and sex drive as well, and contributes to a number of medical problems.
You say the testosterone is actually converted into estrogen?
By fat cells in men, the deep visceral fat cells. So it's not just a spare tire. It's not the stuff on the outside that you can, little love handles. Those are just cosmetics. The stuff on the inside that's hidden, that's dangerous. But we've looked at a way to try to specifically engineer a program that appeals to men, that reverses this process. And it's especially important in light of the reports recently in the medical literature that excess administered testosterone, prescription testosterone, has so many ill effects, as you're aware.
What are the ill effects of people who have, pellets or shots of testosterone? Is that a good way to go about increasing it?
It's not, actually. The testosterone, especially when administered by injection, gives surges that often correlate with an increase in irritability and aggression. But more commonly, testosterone that's prescribed is given as a gel. But the report just yesterday in the PLOS showed that, for the third time, that men get more heart attacks and die earlier, and that men who have administered testosterone also have a reduction in testicle size and shut off their native production of testosterone. So for men, this is really a big deal, because what we want to do is to be able to reverse these processes and eat better so that we lose the gut and actually gain strength instead of lose it.
So how do we do it naturally?
Well, we do it with a really simple eating plan. I think perfect is the enemy of good in eating. And what we want to do is eat fewer processed foods and drink fewer calories. I think those are the secrets. In our program, the Refuel program, we have really simple rules that men like that are, for example, don't eat anything you can crumple or crush, which is our shorthand for don't eat anything that's ultra-processed, because they've taken all the nutrition out and it won't fill you up. And if it's starchy or sugary, it'll make you hungrier instead of be satisfying.
297-5633. The latest work from Dr. John LaPuma is Refuel. He says men are doing a lot of wrong things in our society. We have a sedentary society. We don't exercise. We eat poorly. 20% of the people still smoke. A lot of people drink too much. So with that as the backdrop, a lot of us have a lot of work to do.
But it's a simple start, Jim. The first idea that men should have is that they should know their numbers. They should know their waist size. Your waist should be half your height. And that's a good starting point for men, because that's where the visceral fat is.
That's interesting. I've never heard that. Your waist should be half your height. So I'm
easier than keeping track of calories or pounds on a scale. You can do that too, of course, but it's an easy measure.
Yeah, I'm okay. What's your height, Dr. LaPuma?
I'm 5'6" on a good day, Jim.
So that's 66 inches. Do you have a 33-inch waist or less?
Well, on a good day, I have a 32, but, of course, that goes up and down. But the idea is that you ought to be good, not perfect. You're really aiming for 80 or 90% of the time using my 40 snacks and 25 meal plans and 15 essential recipes. And, by the way, having a partner who wants to help can be life-saving.
Well, yeah,
you're
offering advice to men. Most men or many men have female partners, either spouses or girlfriends or whatever, and you're offering advice to increase testosterone. Women certainly don't want that. So how does this apply to them if they're trying to help their mate?
Well, that's exactly it, Jim. Women who want to help a man or want to help a man get healthy, you get to the doctor and get some of his numbers measured, blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol, waist size, or women who simply want some help in the kitchen really are some of the biggest fans for Refuel, because they find that it's such an easy eating plan and the food is so appealing, the roast chicken with lemon and garlic juices, the grilled sirloin with roasted asparagus, the only guacamole you'll ever need, which has 4 ingredients, takes 10 minutes start to finish, is great for the Super Bowl, better than anything white that was previously in a 5-gallon bucket before it was in an 8-ounce tin in the supermarket. They like the food so much, it's so easy to prepare, and men get feeling better right away on it, that women really are, I think, some of the primary movers for men getting healthy.
And you say you can do this all by diet?
No, actually, it's a four-legged table there. There's a we have short, high-intensity interval training that's just 5 minutes a day in resistance and 5 minutes a day in aerobics to start. We have important sleep steps that allow you to get better sleep, longer and higher quality sleep, because men only make testosterone at night just before REM sleep. And if you don't sleep 6 hours, you have a testosterone level 10 to 15% lower than when you sleep more than 6 hours. And stress management or cortisol control, especially improving mindset, improving productivity, is a key component as well. And we teach men easy tricks to do that and to blunt the chronic cortisol stress surge that so many men have, with the chronic stress that many men have as well.
Dr. John LaPuma, who is a man who knows his information well, an internist. Now, you say that these shots or pellets that people get to boost their testosterone can cause an increase in aggression. Well, what about people who are doing it the natural way? And, you know, some people may have a high level of testosterone to begin with. Others have a low level. If they increase it above a certain level, naturally or otherwise, is there a danger of increased aggression?
That's what we're seeing in some of the research, that the men who have normal levels of testosterone, who take it anyway, have heart attacks or strokes early and have, in fact, not just aggression, but many untoward side effects. That might be because it increases red blood count. It might be because it increases contractility. It's not really clear why. But in our study of men who undertook it just because they wanted to get healthy, 56% had better morning, had better erectile ability, and 62% lost 10 pounds or more and 3 inches around the waist in just 24 days. We presented these data at Stanford Medicine X conference in medicine earlier. So we're actually really optimistic that men who are worried about their testosterone level but actually have a normal testosterone really just need to be able to eat in a way that's specifically engineered for men, that I think addresses problems that are uniquely facing men and leverage their own metabolic advantages, which men have and need to use.
Well, what is a good testosterone level? I just turned 56 years old. I've been tested. Mine generally hovers around 600-700. Is that a decent level, or do I need?
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. You keep that. You have good habits. I'm proud of you.
maybe it's level. Just luck, though. Isn't that like anything else? Some people have it, and some people don't.
Do you have a big waist?
No. I mean, well, I'm bigger than I would like, but I wear a 34-inch waist, and I'm 6'1", so that's 71 inches. So according to you, I'm okay.
Yeah.
But yet,
it's not only according to me, but it's actually according to the medical literature. And not only are you okay, you're doing great. I think that kind of men ought to aim for where you are, in fact. If your waist is less than half your height, you're doing okay. If it's more than half your height, then you can work on it. And actually, it's easier than most men think. It's not a diet, really, because I think men deserve an eating plan. They need to eat enough to be healthy, not to be skinny. And they need something that's easy that I think people making getting healthy and eating right too hard. We created a whole table of easiest steps, and all the recipes don't have any added sugar. They're all gluten-free. There's no toxic calories in them. Men really can take control of this in a way that they haven't learned about before, and because it helps you feel better right away, men begin to think about food as either boosting their testosterone level naturally or converting into estrogen, which is too often the case for men with big guts.
But I've heard that actually if you get up to like 1,000, that's a good testosterone level.
And I would a little worry about that, actually. That's getting to the point where it's a bit high.
Why? Well, how do you determine that?
It's a good question. Those are really laboratory measurements, and the very low level of about 300, the very high level of 1,000 or over for men in their 40s and 50s and 60s are extremes, and they're laboratory examinations that have been extrapolated to numbers. No one really knows what an an exactly high testosterone is or an exactly low testosterone. But we do know that men who have excess internal fat convert the testosterone to estrogen, and that that can be reversed once they lose the visceral fat. Their testosterone levels actually go up. Their estrogen levels actually come down. And that's what my diet does. It treats food as fuel in a way that appeals to men because, you know, if you don't drink your calories, if you don't eat food that you can pump or crush, if you only eat primarily lean protein and strong vegetables, if you drink 3 liters of citrus water instead of soda or juice or energy drinks or some other 10% sugar solution, well, then actually you're going to start to look and feel better and be a little sexier to the women in your life.
John in Jefferson Terrace, you're on with Dr. John LaPuma.
Yes, Dr. LaPuma, I have a question. I am a competitive cyclist, and I have a very low body mass, and it turned out I had low testosterone, and my physician was surprised by that. And have you found any findings relative to athletes having low testosterone?
All right, well, hold on, John. When you say low testosterone, how old are you?
50.
And what was your level?
324.
All right. Well, that would be a bit low. So would you respond, Dr. LaPuma?
Sure. Did he evaluate you for a neurologic problem?
No.
You might want to ask about that simply because if you're a competitive cyclist, you're probably in great shape. And if we see levels that low in men who are in great shape, one of the things that occurs to me are other causes of very low testosterone that are either genetic or organic. So I might want to investigate causes that don't have to do with body fat, but instead have to do with the brain and with the testes primarily. Having said that,
You said earlier that the normal level is like between 300 and 1,000. That's a huge gap, isn't it?
Actually, I'm sorry. I may have misspoken. That 300 is low, 320 is low, and 1,000 is high. A normal level is probably 450 to 750 or 8. It's where you are. You're kind of right in the middle. What's not determined precisely is whether it's 300 or 320 or 350 that is marked of very low testosterone, and that's where some physician judgment comes in. But certainly their caller, John, does have low testosterone, and I would evaluate other reasons for it because it's certainly not his fat.
Well, doesn't the level move around, though? I've been tested several times, and I've been tested as low as 450 and as high as 1,000. Doesn't it move
and
around?
It does move around. It moves around with sleep. It moves around with stress management. It moves around with accumulation of toxins. In fact, some plastics can lower testosterone, particularly bisphenol A, which lowers testosterone and actually converts it into estrogen. It's responsible for gender transformation of frogs. BPA is now outlawed in baby bottles in Canada and the European Union, and is going to be outlawed in the United States. It's on receipts and on the inside of some cans and food cans. So you should buy canned goods BPA-free when you can. You should drink filtered water because it takes a lot of the toxins out of the water. And most importantly, you should wash your hands when you come in the door. You wash your hands after handling thermal paper receipts, like from the gas station or the supermarket, and you should not put plastics in the dishwasher or microwave because some of those toxins, too, are gender-bending and can lower testosterone levels as well.
Should every man be tested?
No, I don't think so. I think the men who are receiving testosterone, however, only about two-thirds of them have been tested, two-thirds to three-quarters. Another third to a quarter are just feeling tired, have asked their doctor for the drug, and the doctor has often prescribed it. But that's not correct. I mean, if you're going to get testosterone, you need to have a testosterone level tested. But many men actually don't need it.
All right.
In fact, only about 5% of men have a very low testosterone in the kind that John has. And the 95% don't. They they generally have, if they're feeling off, if they have lost ambition or drive or initiative, they often have too much internal belly fat. And that's why I wrote Refuel, to help those men get a jump start to use easiest steps and to stop converting testosterone to estrogen.
What about caffeine? We were short on time, but I wanted to ask you about caffeine. You say
it's a good thing. You should drink it.
You should.
You should.
But
you shouldn't if you have a heart arrhythmia or you're sensitive to it in some other way. But no, coffee is a good thing. So is tea. And they improve mental sharpness and have and taste good. And coffee actually is a concentrated source of antioxidants. There's some good data to suggest it reduces diabetes risk as well.
Thank you, Dr. John LaPuma. The book is Refuel, and we'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.